Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're discussing winter budget busters, housing market chill pills, and dying ain't cheap.
I'm a little sad that we ended on such a morose note there at the end of the title of this episode, Joel. But we are going to talk about death during this episode.
Not trying to be downers, but it's the ultimate reality,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and dude, let's talk about insurance, actually. So life insurance, right? That has to do with death. And
it has a lot to do with death.
One of those very...
Everything to do with death.
It's one of those very adulting topics. It's one of those things that is not very interesting. But, and here's the thing, you've had life insurance. I have also had life insurance. I mean, ever since we had our first daughter a number of years ago, I've had that $500,000 life insurance policy in place. Make sure, you know, Kate and the little kiddos are going to be taken care of. That's an important thing to do. Basically, if you have anybody who depends on your income, you need to have life insurance. But since then...
A lot's changed in your life.
Yeah, dude. Well, and I've known over the years that I needed to have upped the amount of coverage that I have. We've got four kids now.
That's a lot more mouths to feed.
It is. And it's right that we have more life insurance set aside as well. And so this is something I finally got around to. And not only me, but you got around to this as well. This is something we both kind of bit the bullet on.
Yeah, this is... I'm not going to say that we're the best at adulting out there, because we're certainly not. And this is probably something we should have done a little while ago, a year or two ago.
Well, we had policies in place.
Yeah, but we had a policy in place, but it's like, okay, now is the time. And here's the interesting thing is that we've talked about this, I think, on a Friday flight, I don't know, maybe like 4 or 5 months back, that like prices for term life policies have actually gone down recently. You would think maybe with the pandemic that would have had the opposite effect, but no, not true. And there's just so much competition in the space. And so, yeah, like you said, we felt the need to have a larger payout amount, especially because of the way that our circumstances have changed in life if we were to die. But the great thing is, term life insurance is still ridiculously cheap. When you look at the numbers, the average cost of a $500,000 policy for 20 years for a 40-year-old is $27 a month.
That is very affordable.
That's cheap protection for the people that you love. And so, yeah, for us, going back and reshopping those rates, I was like, it kind of surprised me that, one, I've gotten older, so I was assuming that my rate would go up. And two, I'm getting a bigger policy amount. And so I'm like, okay, I'm expecting to see maybe double my premium amount. And no, that wasn't the case. Like, yeah. And so if you have an older policy, it might be worth shopping again and ditching the old one, even if you have, like us, as you have gotten older. And yeah, it might be just, and of course it's worth it, I'd say, if you have dependents and you don't have a life insurance policy yet, shopping and seeing what sort of policy works for you or works for your life is like crucial.
Totally, man. I'm glad that this is something that you and I both finally got around to. And again, we had policies in place, but we needed to get some more robust policies in place to make sure our families were taken care of.
One other note, by the way, the internet obviously has made a lot of things more terrible, but a lot of things much easier. And one of the things that it's made easier is shopping for life insurance.
Totally.
We've got an article up on the website. We'll link to it in the show notes, but it's like actually the process that you and I went through,
yep,
to determine how much, you know, we needed in life insurance coverage, and then to actually do the shopping. So we'll put that in the show notes for you. Don't be afraid, I promise. It's not as bad as like a colonoscopy or something like that. I think that's what some people assume. It's really not that bad.
No, it really is pretty easy. And so this is our Friday Flight episode. And every week we tackle a bunch of different headlines and we are going to specifically discuss how they are going to affect your money. And so Joel, how about you kick it off?
Let's do it, Matt. All right, so first we've got a story about shipping times and shipping rates. And we're not talking necessarily about the big container ships off the coast of California. They're trying to work on fixing that problem right now. But if you haven't already noticed, just your regular mail is traveling slower these days. It's basically like snail mail on tranquilizers. We're used to doing everything.
Even slower than you thought.
Exactly. Could it get slower than snail mail? Well, I guess it can. And it's now becoming more expensive to send like commercial and retail packages these days via the United States Postal Service. The mailing slowdown, it's a small part of a 10-year plan to turn things around so that The USPS isn't losing billions of dollars every year, which is what it's currently doing.
Billions with a B.
Yes.
You heard correctly.
Losing lots of money. The Washington Post actually has a helpful tool, though, that we'll link to in the show notes that about how the slowdown is going to affect you personally. And while this is annoying, what sucks even more is that it's going to literally cost more to send packages as well. There's a temporary price hike that started last week. It runs through December 26th, of course, targeting the all-important holiday shipping season. But there is a solution for How to Money listeners. There's a website called EasyShip. There's a website called Parcel Monkey. And those are sites that can help you find the lowest shipping cost by, they look at like UPS, FedEx, USPS, and other
DHL,
shipping companies.
Yeah. All the different companies.
You see them from time to time, but they're not like one of the big three. They're like kind of the...
I'm kind of rooting for them because they're kind of like the underdog.
Let's go DHL. We need more competition in that space, right? So another thing I just want to mention too, when you're talking about shipping and shipping things for less, specifically if you're shipping media items, people often forget that media mail is really, really cheap through USPS.
And like a book.
It takes longer like to ship a book from...
Or a VHS tape.
Right, which I'm doing all the time. But yeah, if you shipped like a book from Georgia to California, it'd probably take like 7 or 8 days. Like media mail... is truly snail mail. It takes quite a while.
It's not fast,
no.
But you are going to be able to save the most money for sure. And this also makes me think of eBay, because I've talked with you recently about how I've been selling some items on eBay recently. Quick little update. I sold that 10-year-old MacBook Air that you remember me telling you about?
How much did you get for it?
$122.50.
That's not bad at all.
That's great for a really old laptop that's no longer accepting software updates. And I mean, I listed out all the specs and you know, this person knew exactly what they're getting, but they just needed to get their hands on an old MacBook Air. I was really surprised to see that those bids continue to climb. But one of the things that eBay does well is that when it does come time to ship, you know, they also list out all the different options, whether it be, you know, FedEx or UPS, even. Well, I don't know if DHL is on there, actually. But like you said, there are these other sites, and you don't have to sell something on eBay in order to be able to easily compare some of the different options for you when it comes to shipping something out of town.
Yeah, and one other thing you can do, Matt, I think, like let's say you want to buy something for your grandkids, or you want to buy something, let's say, for your siblings' kids, like your nephews and nieces, you can send the money to your sister, to your brother, and then like specify the items you want them to buy, just because the shipping costs really are going to completely mess up the economics of shipping gifts potentially. And yeah, that might like put an extra burden on them to have to go out and actually get them and wrap them. Or you can, yeah, if you buy them online, have them shipped directly to that address, obviously, instead of trying to have them shipped to your address and then shipping them another time.
But let's keep moving. Let's talk about insurance. The gargantuan insurance company, Allstate, they want to start charging you based on how you drive, not based on the slew of other factors that are currently being used. You know, we've talked about this before, but your credit score, your age, where you live, all of these things have an impact on your premium, along with other more relevant factors like how many miles you drive and your actual driving history, whether or not you have tickets. But now, I'll say they want to use telematic technology to monitor your specific driving behavior.
Does that mean they're going to read my mind, Matt?
Nobody wants to go there, Joel. let's be honest. But they want to monitor how it is we actually drive in real life in order to create this you know, very specific premium based on, you know, the specific risk profile of your driving behavior. And so depending on how you drive, like this is either going to be great news because you're thinking, yes, finally I get to be rewarded for driving like a, you know, like a granny. You're over there doing that fist pump. Or maybe on the other hand, you're completely horrified because you know how you drive.
Oh, you know who you are, and you're cringing right now as you're listening to this. This is a tough one, Matt. Like, there are obviously certain privacy concerns with this sort of technology, where your insurance company knows every single move that you make in your automobile. It makes me think of, you know, we talked about life insurance at the beginning. Like, what if my life insurance company had a tracker on my person, and it's like, we know you went skydiving last week, Joel. Like, we're raising your rate, and it's like, well, that's creepy too.
Looks like you went hiking in an area where you were at least 30 minutes from a hospital, you're going to get dinged for that.
Exactly, yeah. And so I actually kind of like the current setup that a lot of insurance companies offer. You can opt to have your driving tracked if you so choose. But if you do, it's usually for just a limited time. And after a few months, you get rid of the tracker that helped set your rate after they acquire the driving data that they need, and they see like, well, how hard do you brake? Do you stop at red lights? And like, how quickly do you accelerate? They get all that stuff within 60 to 90 days, and then you're done. You send the tracker back. But being tracked in perpetuity, that doesn't sound really awesome to me. Even though it is happening in so many other areas of our lives already, I think what Allstate's trying to do here is maybe just biting off a little too more than they can chew, and more really than a lot of consumers are ready for.
Yeah. Well, on a similar note, something else we've been seeing more of is what experts are calling tattleware. And this is software on your work computer, like your laptop at home, that monitors everything from, you know, the different sites that you visit all the way to different programs. And get this, because this is crazy. This is software that takes a live photo of you every minute or so as employers are, you know, attempting to keep tabs on their workers.
If you went to go get a sip of coffee from the kitchen, your employer's like, going to know about it.
Looks like you're AWOL. Like, what happened?
For 2.5 minutes there.
Fact is, though, like, this is becoming more widespread. And, you know, for a lot of folks, this is maybe just an acceptable trade-off to working from home. But to others, I think to a lot of people, this is going to be a serious invasion of privacy. As they know that this is happening as your, you know, employer, they might be looking to implement something similar. But I think especially keep this in mind if you're job hunting, you know, keep an eye out for this as it might be maybe the deciding factor for you if you're choosing between two otherwise comparable offers. You've got one company who's basically they're going to trust you, and you got another company who's going to take a picture of you every 60 seconds, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the key word, Matt, trust. And I think when an employer hires someone, what they're saying is, what they should be saying is, I trust you to do the job that I've hired you to do.
Yeah.
And if you have to have this sort of tattleware running in the background, to me, that reeks of poor management and
overreach.
It's a place that I wouldn't want to work. And so
I would take my shirt off and be like, there's no policy in the company handbook that says I can't work with my shirt off.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll stop that policy.
Yeah. Because nobody wants to see
They're that. They're like, oh, yeah. HR has reached out to us. They said that. Never mind.
Yeah. So I mean, really, listeners can do what they will. Yeah. I do think that this stuff is going to be rolled out in more and more companies. And it's something you got to look out for and watch out for yourself, because it's creepy and it's probably something that my guess is a lot of workers are not going to be comfortable with.
Yeah, and I feel like it's probably closer at hand than we realize as well.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, let's talk about the housing market for a second, Matt. And the question on a lot of people's minds right now is the housing market actually calming down? Because it's been nutso. Been nutso out there. And there are actually a few signs that point to the answer of yes.
That's what Joel's Magic 8 housing market ball says. Exactly. You like, take that and you shake it up.
All signs point to yes. And so, yeah, for like folks who have become obsessed with tracking the meteoric rise of their home's value on Zillow, this is probably a little bit of a bummer. They're like, it was worth $350 like 2 years ago, and now it's worth $475. Well, woohoo! But for everyone else, this is welcomed. If you care less about that and you're more like, I'm trying to buy a house, like you are excited to see the softening of home prices. And yeah, the few signs that we're talking about, well, there are far fewer bidding wars happening right now compared to what was happening in like spring and early summer. Also, a lot more appraisals are coming in low, and that's leading to certain deals blowing up. And that's because lenders almost always refuse to lend money beyond the appraisal price. It's true that appraisals have like a subjective nature to them, which still irks me, but I don't know that there's any real way around that. Matt, we've talked about some of those companies that use like learning algorithms to actually try to create a better value around homes. I still like that technology, and I think it's going to be implemented more and more. But yeah, appraisers, human appraisers, are often relying on subjective data that's like a month or two old when it comes to home sales. And in a market where prices have escalated quickly, it can be really hard to come up with a firm value. That's especially true in older neighborhoods where you and I live. It's almost impossible to get an accurate value for a home when there are even more variables. And when it comes to age, modifications that have been made, and it's just kind of another sign maybe that, not that the housing market is crashing, not saying that, I don't believe that, but that it is softening a little bit. And
yeah, it's cooling a little bit.
Yeah, it's going to be easier if you are trying to buy a home to actually get one than it's been at least over the last 6, 8, 10, 12 months.
Yeah, and we're starting to see interest rates start to tick up a little bit too. And, you know, historically low rates have obviously been one of the major factors leading to the rapid rise in prices that we've seen over the last 12, 18 months. And another one of these factors as well is that demand is slowing as many buyers are choosing to wait out this insanity altogether. So again, does this mean we're likely going to see prices decline back to levels from 2 years ago? We don't think so. There are a lot of factors at play here, and so we'll be sure to keep our eyes peeled. We'll keep talking about this because I know there are so many of our listeners who are glad to see the housing prices, you know, not continue this meteoric rise, especially as they're looking to purchase their very first home.
No doubt. I think for a lot of reasons, it's good to see, you know, home prices soften and not escalate nearly as quickly. It's just not good for our economy to have real estate outprice the wage gains to that extent. But yeah, we've got more that we want to get to on this Friday flight, including how dying has gotten more expensive. We'll get to that right after this.
All right, this is our Friday flight, and it is now time to talk about dying. And specifically, we're going to get to this story within our ludicrous headline of the week. So this one comes from Wired, and the headline goes, "How Big Funeral Made the Afterlife So Expensive." I love these headlines.
Wait, is there an entrance fee into heaven now? Is that what that's about?
Basically. So recently, the average cost of a funeral was just shy of $10,000, and the average cost of a cremation was over $6,500. That one in particular shocked me because, I mean, first of all, both of these numbers shocked me because that's just a lot of money to spend, you know, on, like, after someone actually passes. Like, we're not even talking about the other expenses leading up to, you know, maybe what got them to that point. But cremation in particular, that was supposed to be the affordable way,
right,
to not have to go through all the, you know, pomp and circumstance of having an actual ceremony and funeral, that kind of thing.
I would have thought if you'd asked me that cremation would to cost maybe 20% of the amount, not, or 65% of the amount.
Like 10%. Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. Like, I would expect it to be much more affordable. But consolidation in the industry, this is leading to less competition and higher prices. So we're talking about caskets and urn markups that can get as high as 500%. And so one important note that's worth mentioning is that you can BYOC, which is bring your own casket. Jill, you're going to love this because you're going to be like the most excited person to hear this. Costco, they sell really nice caskets.
Dude,
that's
my place.
They got you from cradle to grave, dude.
Get the diapers for the babies, get the casket for, you know, it's a beautiful place.
So you don't have to take those high funeral costs laying down.
I see what you did there.
Is it too soon?
No, that's fine.
Okay, bad joke.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think, yeah, it was interesting to read this article and see that, yeah, just kind of like what's happening in when it comes to some of the medical facilities in larger cities around the country, there's more and more consolidation happening and prices are shooting up at higher rates because of it. I don't like seeing it. And yeah, many of us, I'll say, have become more acquainted with death maybe than we wanted to become over the past 18 months. And I got to say, like, Matt, I appreciate your jokes, but we really do hope that everyone and their families are okay.
Sure,
like,
totally.
COVID has impacted a whole lot of families, like, and friendships around the country.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we wish you well and we hope that you're in good health, but fact is, death is a part of our life.
Yes, for sure. And so, on that note, Matt, I think it's good for us to think about our own mortality, and some of my favorite books actually are ones about death. I just recommend a couple real quick. Being Mortal and When Breath Becomes Air are a couple that have just, I go back to as just fantastic books that I think help you think about death in a good way. We'll link to them in the show notes if you're interested. They're really, really good. You can get them from on your Libby app through the library too. But yeah.
Sitting on my shelf, actually.
Is it?
Yes. When Breath Becomes Air, that one in particular, you mentioned that to me like a few weeks ago. I was like, oh, that one sounds really good.
Oh, dude, it's so good. You're gonna love it.
Gonna go with the audio version, audiobook with that one.
That's what I did. I like audiobooks. But yeah, while it is actually healthy to contemplate the brevity of life, and I think that's healthy for us when it comes to our money, when it comes to like being more intentional, overpaying for your eventual death is not healthy for your wallet, for your family's finances. The best way around this, we would say, is to join your state's funeral and memorial society. We'll put a link to the website funerals.org in the show notes where you can find your local chapter. The cool thing is there's a really minimal fee to join, like $10 to $25 usually, and then that qualifies you for rates that are a quarter of the national average or less through contracted providers with published upfront rates. So you you know what you're getting ahead of time, and you're not nickel and dimed on the back end. There's also a website called Funeralocity, kind of like Travelocity for funerals. And so that
we're going to get you there faster.
They do a good job,
or cheaper, I guess,
of literally taking the publish rates like from around the web, from all of these smaller funeral homes near where you live, and putting them in fine print and organizing it for you, so you can see like, okay, cool. If I go to this one down the street, I'm going to pay three times as much. And so yeah, we'll link to that one in the show notes too. Sorry to talk about death so much. We don't want to be a bummer, but I think it's it makes me so mad to think that people are getting ripped off in the middle of the time when shopping around is harder to do because of like the emotional difficulty you're going through.
Sure. And here's the thing. You said like that we're sorry for talking about death, and like don't apologize. Like, this is something that we do need to talk about more. And so just like with money, the more conversations that we have around this, especially if you have maybe some, you know, like older parents or somebody who has a health condition, it is worth talking about. We don't want the fear of a topic to lead to poor outcomes down the road.
Which I think is exactly what happens. It's like, we don't want to talk about this, and we put it off to the last minute, and then we get hoodwinked in the middle of the extenuating circumstance. And hopefully just, you know, knowing this small bit of information can help you make a better decision to save you likely thousands and thousands of dollars. Because, yeah, when you look at that average price for a cremation you mentioned, Matt, $6,500.
That's too much.
Through a lot of these funeral memorial societies, you're talking about literally right in the $900 to $1,000 range for a cremation. So, yeah, we're literally talking about huge savings.
I think I want to, I would like to get cremated and then like maybe spread out either on like a river or like in the mountains, like that kind of thing. Like, seriously.
All right.
I don't think I'd want to be there.
Folgers can style or...
Well, I don't know. You can get something nicer.
That's still one of my favorite scenes in any movie, The Big Lebowski. It's so good.
Maybe we'll post a GIF of that or something. All right. We talked about the rising cost of gas a little bit in last week's Friday flight. But energy costs in general are heading higher overall. And that doesn't bode well for your winter heating bill. Natural gas prices in particular, they have doubled in the last 6 months. Coal prices, they've also hit a record as well. And the sucky thing is, just like we discussed with gas prices, demand is mostly going to be inelastic when it comes to your heating bill. You know, you can't just like stop heating your house in January because it's costing you too much. I mean, you could, I guess, but for a lot of folks, there's only a certain amount that they're willing to sacrifice. They have a level of comfort that they want to stick to.
Right? Yeah, they might be willing to lose a couple of degrees to save some money, but they're not turning it off altogether.
Most folks aren't willing to wear a jacket inside their homes.
Or get frostbite.
Like I often do, or used to do, I should say. And so instead, you're probably going to have to pull back on spending in other places if you're looking to stick to your budget. We mention this because we want you to be cognizant of the reality that those bills are likely to be quite a bit higher than they were last winter. And so start thinking now of different ways you could potentially cut back in spending in other areas of your budget.
Yep, you just want to assume that increase is coming because it probably is. And yeah, on the flip side, Matt, renewable sources of energy are actually getting much cheaper. A new report from the Institute of New Economic Thinking, which is our light bathroom reading around here.
Of course.
It showed that estimates about the declining costs of renewable sources like solar and wind have actually been way off. We've actually underestimated how quickly prices would decline in the past. And so yet nobody was really predicting how cheap solar energy would be at this point in time back in, let's say, the year 2010. And we actually talked with our friend Carl Jensen on Monday's episode. And this dude, he is self-installing whole house solar for only $11,000.
That's pretty nice.
Which is pretty impressive. But even that is a big outlay up front. Like, a lot of people can't afford to do that and they've got to save up for it. But it might be worth looking into installing solar at your house. It could curb your overall energy costs over time. Like that $11,000, I'm curious to see how much it saves Carl over the next 10 years. My guess is he makes that payback off in, I don't know, 5 to 6 years. I'll have to ask him. But it's important to note too that there's still a great federal tax credit to the tune of 26% through the end of next year. So if solar is on your radar, and as energy prices are ticking up, you might want to consider doing it sooner than you thought before. And yeah, if you want to like research more, there's this website, energysage.com, which I think is a great place to get started, kind of get some facts and figures, and there's calculators there to help you kind of decide, you know, whether it's right for you. And then to even find like a qualified local installer, if that's the route you want to go in.
If you're not going to DIY it yourself.
And I think actually
that's redundant, isn't it? DIY yourself. It's like saying an ATM machine.
Right. It's like when
one of those words isn't necessary.
Yeah. And I think actually in some locales you have to check, they won't let you self-install. And so you might have to hire a professional. I know where Carl lives in Colorado, at least it might be a down to a city thing, I'm not sure, but where he is at, he's allowed to go the DIY route. But even still, I'm sure not many people do it.
That's right. You know, and some of these decreased prices are due to the incentives provided by the different tax credits out there. But it, you know, it also has to do with the fact that companies are responding to the fact that we've gotten past the point of like a minimum viable audience or a minimum viable customer, right? There are enough people who are now interested in something like solar, like folks like Carl, that like there's just more attention and there's more innovation that's being directed towards these technologies. Seth Godin wrote about this recently, and he calls it contagious commerce. And it's this idea that there's a multiplier effect when we decide to make changes in how or what it is that we consume. And so Seth, he said that, and this is a quote, like very few people have the leverage to change the world, but all of us have the chance to change the people around us. And those actions change what gets built, what gets funded and launched. And so I don't know, I just found that really encouraging from the standpoint of, oftentimes in the world, it feels like we're just a very small cog. Like we're just very small, and it's like, oh,
almost invisible.
Yeah, what kind of change am I going to have on this larger system? But what we do actually does matter, and we have an impact on those around us, and then all of us collectively have a larger impact, and then that continues to cascade. And so I think that's just important to keep in mind as we're thinking through any change that we're looking to implement in our lives and in our world.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think with the rise of influencers and social media, we kind of want our impact to be bigger. But the biggest impact we can have is usually in direct relationship to a smaller number of people close to where we live and who we get to actually spend time with consistently. So yeah, that's good stuff. And Matt, let's talk quickly about 529 plans for a second. Public school kids in New York City, actually, it turns out they're getting free money towards their higher education inside of a 529 accounts. This is actually a public and nonprofit partnership, which is attempting to address the widening wealth gap by giving these kids, these public school kids, some money to start growing in order to help pay for their future college costs.
A little bit of seed money.
Exactly. And the thing
literally,
is,
it's tiny. It's just seed money.
It is, yeah, because it's $100. In addition to that, kids can earn up to an additional $200 potentially. So yeah, like $300 plus the growth on that money. It's like you said, it's small. It's not going to pay for you to get your whole Harvard education if you right. did if you did end up getting accepted.
Nope. Not going to cover it.
Right. But that money does start compounding early for these kids, and that will be real tangible money in 2035, let's say. But here's the thing. The best way to teach kids and their parents, in reality, about money is hands-on stuff like this. Putting $100 in a vehicle like a 529 account not only helps to fund a small portion of that future college career for that one kiddo, but it also creates excitement about investing for the future. Kids with even just a small amount of money saved are actually three times more likely to attend college. I forget where that stat came from, but I found it fascinating that just having a small amount of money means they're way, way, way more likely to actually follow through. It's like someone believed in me enough to put $200 in this account, yeah. And now it's grown to $2,000 over the course of 18 years. And so now, you know what? I got to use that money. I got to go get an education. So I think, yeah, the money is important, but the motivation that that money is creating for some of these kids, it might be even more important. I kind of love seeing this happen.
Yeah, and it continues to provide that those incentives to encourage parents to continue to save towards a child's education as well, right? It removes those barriers to entry, and it basically nudges those parents in that direction. And I think that psychological benefit that it provides is much bigger than the actual dollar amount, because it's like, all right, you know, a total of $300, that's great, but the ability to, you know, for a parent to see themselves as somebody, I am somebody who puts money towards my kid's college now, and it just makes it easier for them. I mean, in the same way that we see like workplace, you know, retirement plans, those are nudges that to encourage those folks to save for their retirement.
The auto opt-in makes a huge difference. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that like that's one downside I could see to this program specifically is there are a lot of folks who have workplace sponsored retirement accounts, but if they don't, and instead they're being nudged to do something like save towards their kid's education, which is a good thing, but if they're not saving towards their own retirement, that is something that is a priority in our mind that comes first, and then the kids' education. So this is one downside, is that it could potentially foster and lead to behavior that, you know, where the cart gets a little bit ahead of the horse.
Yeah, where they keep contributing to the 529 as opposed to saying, wait, I'm investing for their future. Now I got to start investing
for
my own.
What about myself?
Totally. Yeah.
Exactly. And since we're talking about college, where do those 529 funds go the furthest? Well, at your local community college. And there's this recent study that that found that community colleges actually work, which, you know, you might find hard to believe, but we often mention them as sort of this great alternative to more expensive routes that you could take to get a degree. But a lot of folks scoff when they hear us mention that, assuming that a community college degree isn't as worthwhile as one from a traditional four-year school. But we would encourage you to think again, because we saw that more than 90% of surveyed community colleges are actually changing the programs that they offer based on feedback from local employers. And so that means that folks who are getting a degree from a community college there in town are going to be job ready in most cases. And so that's encouraging, because sometimes attending the right local school, it's not only going to save you tuition money, but it's also going to prepare you better for the jobs that are actually available. It feels much more practical than going off to like a four-year liberal arts school where you're going to get a degree, but maybe you're like, oh, philosophy, not totally sure what direction I'm going to go after that. I think for a lot of folks, having something practical that's grounded towards a specific industry and even a specific employer could be a better route to take.
Yeah, and there cheap or free in some states. And so, Matt, I think, I don't know if we're on actual like Blues Brothers style mission to do this, but let's make community colleges cool again, because they deserve it. And I feel like they're underrated, really, and a lot more people should consider them. I think there are a lot of just misconceptions out there when it comes to community colleges
All
around. But that's going to do it for this episode. For folks who want the show notes and links to all the sites we mentioned, those are going to be on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And we've got a great Ask How to Money episode lined up for you this coming Monday. And by the way, we want to hear your questions. There is no question out there that's too weird, that is too unique. You might feel that this is going to be, you've got something in mind that's not going to be applicable to other people. But to be honest, the more unique, the better. It makes the show a lot more fun for us. And also, it's going to be applicable to more people than you think.
Yeah, no doubt. The weirder, the better. But that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.